From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Journalist John Krakauer's beat is the Earth's most inaccessible places and the men and women who journey there. Krakauer writes about mountaineering and rock climbing. He's a climber himself, and on this edition of Fresh Air, Krakauer joins us with tales of adventure, fear, and embarrassment. Also today, vocalist Bobby McFerrin tells us about his new project, his 10-member a cappella group, The Voicestra. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward describes Liverpool's second musical revolution, the one after the Beatles. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Journalist and the Murderer, Janet Malcolm's examination of the relationship between writer Joe McGinnis and convicted murderer Jeffrey McDonald, the subject of McGinnis's book Fatal Vision. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A three-man delegation led by a Lithuanian deputy prime minister met in Moscow today with one of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev's top advisors. The delegates talked with Politburo member Alexander Yakovlev, while the Soviet parliament passed a new law on secession less than 1 month after Lithuania's declaration of independence. Benjamin Rowe reports from Moscow.
These are consultations and conversations, not negotiations, emphasized the Lithuanians, confirming at a press conference tonight that Yakovlev had met with the Vilnius delegation led by Deputy Prime Minister Romualdas Ozolas. But it was the clearest sign yet that both sides may be looking for a way out of the crisis over the Baltic Republic's March 11th break from Moscow. Earlier, the emissaries had been rebuffed both by Defense Minister Dmitry Yazov and President Gorbachev. Meanwhile, the Soviet parliament passed a tough new law on secession today that set stiff measures for splitting with the Union. Requirements include a two-thirds majority referendum in the Republic, followed by a five-year waiting period, and final confirming votes from the Republican and National Parliaments. Deputies from the Baltic states boycotted the vote. For National Public Radio, I'm Benjamin Rowe in Moscow.
South African police and soldiers are patrolling today in Natal province, where factional fighting over the past week has killed scores of people and driven thousands from their homes. Black leader Nelson Mandela said his supporters doubted the neutrality of the security forces. Supporters of a group linked to Mandela's African National Congress have been fighting with a Zulu independence group known as INCATA. Mandela said many of his supporters believe the police are sympathetic to INCATA. Mandela is scheduled to meet with South African President F.W. de Klerk on Thursday. The Pentagon today released some pictures and information about the stealth fighter. The airplane's been operational since 1983, but kept secret until recently. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Unlike its larger cousin, the stealth bomber, which has a rounded, sculpted look, the two-engine, single-seat stealth fighter is all angles and sharp edges. When Lockheed delivers the last two of the subsonic jets to the Air Force this year, there will be 56 of them. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams.
It's primarily a tactical aircraft that has a specific nighttime mission, which is to have very low observability.
In fact, the first combat the stealth fighter saw was during last December's U.S. invasion of Panama, where two of the jets each dropped a laser-guided bomb in a nighttime raid near a Panamanian Defense Forces barracks. The Pentagon has spent some $6.25 billion on the stealth fighter, a cost of $106 million per plane, about a fifth of the cost of the B-2 stealth bomber. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 36.25 points to close at 2,736.7. This is NPR. The House today approved $720 million in foreign aid spending for Panama and Nicaragua. The package includes $30 million for the resettlement of the Nicaraguan Contra rebels and their families. President Bush had asked for a total of $800 million, and he's repeatedly urged the Congress to act quickly. The measure now goes to the Senate, where it may face further delays. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said yesterday that Congress shouldn't provide the full amount until the administration comes up with a coordinated global plan for foreign aid. Researchers find evidence that a healthy lifestyle can reduce the risk of heart attack, even among men considered at high risk. Patricia Naiman has this report on a study published in this week's New England Journal of Medicine.
The 12,000 high-risk men involved in this study, which came to be known as Mr. Fit, either smoked cigarettes, had high blood pressure, or had high blood cholesterol. Half of the men were strongly encouraged to make permanent lifestyle changes, to reduce their fat intake, to change their diets, lose weight, and stop smoking. After 10 years, many men in this group did make changes and, as a result, reduced their risk of heart attack by 24%. But those behavior changes didn't seem to make any difference in whether the men came down with other diseases or died from other diseases. Even so, researchers say these findings show that changing bad habits, even after years, can be beneficial to your health. This is Patricia Naimond reporting.
Authorities say that the danger is largely over from an oil spill that threatened the water supplies of 1 million people in the Pittsburgh area. A number of towns along the Allegheny River were forced to close their water intake systems while the oil slick made its way downriver. An Allegheny County spokesman said the slick has now moved away from the most populous areas. Officials say the cleanup efforts have reduced the threat. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Krakauer is a mountain climber and journalist. He begins his new book with this observation. Mountain climbing is comprehended dimly, if at all, by most of the non-climbing world. It's a favorite subject for bad movies and spurious metaphors. A dream about scaling some high, jagged alp is something a shrink can really sink his teeth into. The activity is wrapped in tales of audacity and disaster that make other sports out to be trivial games by comparison. It's the aim of this book to prune some of this overgrown mystique. Krakauer has climbed some of the most challenging mountains around the world. He's written about his own climbs and about several of the world's top climbers. His new book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of his articles from Outside and Smithsonian magazines. In the book, Krakauer tells of times during his climbs when he's asked himself, should I turn back? I asked him if there's often a moment during a climb when he asks that.
Yeah, there almost always is. And that point is actually, I mean, almost always when you start a climb, there's incredible doubts, and you're scared. You usually haven't slept well the night before. You're nervous. You're worried, is the weather going to turn? Is there an avalanche going to come down? But at some point in most climbs, at least long alpine climbs, you reach a point where you have to decide either we're going to keep going and go for the top or retreat. And once you sort of pass that point, say, we're going to commit, we're going to go for it, we're going to ignore the storm coming in. It's this incredible relief. You sort of don't have to worry about it anymore. You get zoned in on the climb. You don't really notice the passage of time. It's just sort of, it's this transcendental moment that it's wonderful. That's what you sort of climb for. You can't you can't predict when that will happen. And when you do retreat, I really regret some of the climbs I didn't do. I wonder if I was just being chicken when I turned around or I should have kept going. I mean, it stays with you for decades, so.
Let me ask you about one of the climbs that you didn't complete, and that was climbing the Eiger. Can you describe the Eiger and what makes it such a challenging mountain?
Basically, it's caught the public imagination because it's just so damn dangerous. It's not a particularly attractive mountain. It's sort of this pyramid with a one face has been scooped away, so you have this vertical concave face that's dark, faces north, it's always covered with ice. The rock is not very good, so if you stand at the base of it, you hear a constant shower of rock and ice. Sort of a sinister, ugly, scary peak. Killed a lot of people before it was first climbed. And somehow its mystique owes to that dangerous image. And I don't know, every climber I've ever known someday dreams or has nightmares about climbing the Eiger. It's just one of those things. It has to do, it's sort of perverse, but then climbing itself is perverse. I don't know, I'd always thought about climbing the Eiger since I was very young. And when I had the chance to do it I actually was paid to do it for a magazine assignment, I leapt at the chance. And that is, having failed on that climb, I still second guess. And I still think about going back someday, although it makes my palms sweat to even consider that.
Well, what prevented you from finishing the climb?
It had been, I was there in October. It had been the wettest fall in the Swiss Alps in over 100 years. So we waited for 3 weeks for the weather to get good, but it kept storming. The face was plastered with snow and ice. You couldn't see the handholds underneath. You couldn't get anchors. So we got about halfway up, and we were going slow. The climbing was much more difficult than usual. And it became clear that, when I did that climb, I think I was 30. And at that point, I gained a little common sense, and I realized that this is really pushing our luck. I mean, it's not worth... When I was younger, I thought certain climbs might be worth dying for. By the time I was 30, I no longer thought that. And I thought that at this point on the Eiger, with ice coming down and... You know, basically, there was no anchors. If one of us slipped, we were roped together, we both would have fallen 3,000 feet, and you're reminded of this constantly. And I decided that I'd had enough. It was time to go down. My younger partner really just was disappointed in me for suggesting that we go down. He didn't understand what I was upset about. He thought that there's still a pretty good chance we might live and might, in fact, get to the top, and it was worth it for him. So we had a disagreement there on the face with falling ice falling around us, but our friendship has been patched up since then.
Well, how do you decide who wins when somebody wants to continue the climb and the other person wants to go back?
It can be difficult. Basically, whoever argues the loudest. The guy who wants to go down has the advantage because he can just refuse to keep going.
Good point, yeah.
He can untie from the rope and start down, but... Generally, it's understood that you listen to the sort of the person who wants to go down. It's just sort of when you begin the climb, it's understood that everyone has the right to veto the climb, in effect. Although sometimes nowadays in the Himalaya, especially, there's sort of a different frame of mind where it's every man for himself. They enter into it knowing that if one person gets in trouble, the other person might keep going or leave that person. As the stakes get higher, the game gets stranger, I guess.
John Krakauer is my guest. He's a mountain climber and journalist, and his new book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of articles that he's written about mountain climbing, his own climbs and climbs of others. For those of us who've never done a climb like this, can you describe what kind of gear you have, how you're attached to each other as you're scaling this mountain?
On something like the Eiger? Well,
yeah.
And that time of year in late October, the days are short. The climbing was difficult, so we estimated it would take 2 or 3 days to get up the climb. So on your back, you're carrying a knapsack with a light sleeping bag, a stove to melt snow for water, maybe 40 pounds of clothing and gear. In each hand, you have an ice axe, which is sort of everyone knows what an ice axe looks like, sort of like a pick with a droop pick. It's maybe 2 feet long. On your feet, you have a grid of metal spikes called crampons, two of which point forward from the toe of the boot, and you kick those into the ice, maybe half an inch. Often you're climbing on an ice climb, the picks of your ice axes will be in maybe half inch, your crampons maybe a quarter inch, and that's what's sort of holding you to the world. So, but you learn to try, I mean, you learn what will... Rarely in climbing do you fall when you don't expect to. When you've climbed long enough, you know when something's going to give way and drop you into the void. So you sort of avoid those situations. Or if you think you might fall, you make sure your rope is well anchored, or if you can. Sometimes you can't, which is what keeps the game interesting. Climbing is a strange sport in that it's generated an incredible body of literature, even though relatively few people climb. In this country, it's estimated maybe 150,000 people climb. In Europe, many more people climb. It's more of a mainstream sport. But the body of literature of mountaineering is rivaled probably only by baseball and fly fishing, which tells you something that this is a sort of a very interesting, complicated sport. Climbing, it's the only sport I know of that idealizes risk. By that I mean that if you want to be a great climber, it's not enough just to do hard, difficult climbs. You also have to do dangerous climbs, like someone might do a hard rock climb, and if someone else does it without the rope, that's considered better. And this is sort of, boldness is at a premium in climbing. It's sort of amazing to me that society condones this sport. I suspect that's largely because it's not very well understood. But in this country, only about 25 to 40 people die every year, which isn't... I recently read that some actuarial experts were polled who... This was, I think, a few years ago, and they listed climbing as the 29th most dangerous activity you could do, right behind operating a power lawnmower. So maybe it's not really that dangerous.
Well, so. Tell me what rescue insurance is and how you get it.
Well, that doesn't really exist in this country. It's in the Alps, where climbing really is a mainstream sport. It's probably climbing, skiing, soccer, say, in France, or what they call football, or you know, that's what, like, baseball, basketball, football here. And so hundreds, thousands of people climb in the Alps. The Alps are swarming with people of all ages, from small kids to people in their 70s and 80s. With that many people, there's a lot of, maybe 300 or 400 people die every year, thousands get in trouble. There's a highly developed, sophisticated rescue system where helicopters are always standing by. If you get in trouble, you can send off a flare or radio, and they'll come pluck you from the walls if they can right away. And these are expensive. So before you, if you're smart, before you start climbing, you in France, I think now it's about $70 a year. You plunk down your $70. And then if you get rescued, the gendarmerie does not send you the $2,000 bill for the rescue. So that's what rescue insurance is. In this country, there aren't enough climbers. Mountain rescue is handled by sheriff departments who really aren't equipped or trained to deal with it. You're pretty much on your own in this country, which is the way it should be. I think if you enter into a climb thinking, well, if I get in trouble, I'll call for a rescue, you shouldn't be doing that climb. I mean, it sort of goes against the grain of the sport. The sport is grounded in self-reliance.
Have you ever been rescued?
No, I've thought about it. on the Eiger, I purchased rescue insurance twice before I went up on the Eiger, and a couple of years ago when I did a lot of solo climbing in Chamonix, France, at the foot of Mont Blanc. And once on a climb in the Mont Blanc Massif, a long, difficult ice climb, I was getting tired, my ice axes were dull, I was over my head and in trouble, and a helicopter flew by and paused for a minute to see if I was in trouble, and all I would have had to do was raise one arm, or maybe it was two arms, I forget, to signal this helicopter that I wanted a rescue, and you know, a cable would have come down and I could have been plucked from the wall. But I thought about it for a minute, and I just didn't know what I was going to tell the guy. I was too embarrassed, so I waved him away and continued the climb. Rescue carries a stigma to me that I'd be embarrassed to have to be rescued, although if I was in big trouble, I wouldn't hesitate to call to save my neck. I'm not that principled.
Yeah. Well, this leads to something I was thinking about before when we were talking about the decision that you always face on a climb, about whether or not you want to turn back. Well, say you decide you've had it, you're exhausted, you can't possibly make the climb, it's too dangerous and you're going to turn back. Well, it's not like you're on the ground already. First, you have to get there, so you're still exposing yourself to all these dangers.
Are there
any simple ways out if you want to bail out?
Well, if you're in the Alps, you can fire off your flare and the gendarmerie will come and you rescue it. Most of the time, there isn't an easy way out, which is why it's so tense. Because during the day when you've got cold feet, you're wondering whether you really want to be doing this, every foot higher you climb is another foot you're going to have to go down. So it's not, this is in the back of your mind all the time. You're beneath a very difficult section. You wonder, God, if I climb that, you know, and I turn back, I'm going to have to come down it. And there are climbs when it becomes retreat becomes impossible, at least on the route you're on, where you do have to go over the top. Very overhanging walls where it's very difficult to descend an overhanging wall because you basically drop a rope, slide down the rope, reattach it, slide down it again. And if the wall's overhanging, the rope's hanging in space, and you can't necessarily swing into the wall. So, yeah, it's an interesting – what is it? Royal Robbins, a very famous climber, once said climbing is a great sport, not in spite of the demands that it puts on us, but precisely because of them. And that's something that sort of made a lot of sense to me. So,
let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about mountain climbing. And my guest is John Krakauer, who's a climber and a journalist, and he's written a lot of pieces about mountain climbing, and several of them are collected in his new book, Eiger Dreams, Ventures Among Men and Mountains. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
We're talking about mountain climbing, and my guest is climber and journalist John Krakauer. Have changes in equipment made new climbs possible?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, equipment is so much better just in the last 10 years. I mean, I've been climbing. I'll be 36 in a week, and I've been climbing since I was 8. And in those 28 years, the equipment has improved so much. So people are doing harder and harder climbs, but they're not really doing anything more challenging. I mean, you look back at the guys at Ed Hillary and Tenzing Norgay who climbed Everest with, you know, the gear they use. That's much more impressive than the people who climb Everest today. You know, in the 20s, these British gentlemen were attempting Everest from the north wearing, you know, tweed jackets and putties and... God forbid. It's incredible. I mean, it sends shivers down my back. So, yeah, climbing is... A lot of climbers sort of rant and rave about how the sport's getting too easy, gear is making it too easy. And that's probably true, but I don't see anyone, or very few people, willfully or intentionally eschew modern gear for old gear. A lot of people will limit the gear they use. I mean, solo climbing, climbing without a rope is popular in certain circles because of... It's a way of keeping the climbing by fair means, was the term Ronald Messner coined, where you climb the highest peaks in the world without oxygen, or you do hard rock climbs without a rope. So, I mean, that keeps you honest, definitely.
I think one of the recent types of climbs is climbing frozen waterfalls. This is something done a bit of. Can you describe that?
Yeah, it's... The sport was only made possible in the early 70s when Yvon Chouinard, a very famous climber, brilliant designer, invented an ice axe that allowed you to climb vertical ice. He put a little curve in the pick so it wouldn't pop out when you're hanging on vertical ice. So basically you have a water, you know, everyone knows what a waterfall looks like in the summer. And in winter, in cold places, these waterfalls freeze into these surreal structures, these amazing, bizarre, otherworldly pillars of ice, many of which, you know, can be 1,000 feet high. More often, they're only 400 or 500 feet high. But it's a really so it's sort of one of the latest facets of the game. And you start at the bottom, you swing your ice axes until they stick, you kick your crampons in, and you just go up. You know, every time you swing your ice axe, you move up another 20 inches. Say you have to be alert. Icicles, as you might imagine, are fragile, so you sort of have to pay attention to where you're swinging your ice axe. It's pretty neat. It's definitely you get jazz climbing frozen waterfalls. It's cold generally. Sometimes they're dripping water, and then the water freezes on you. Climbing, you know, can be looked at as a pretty masochistic activity, although that sort of simplifies it. It's not. I mean, it's. After a hard climb, you know, you have this glow that just lasts for days, where you just kind of walk around in this fog, this euphoria, and that's sort of why you do it. Also, you do it because, like on a very hard climb, you're so intensely focused and concentrating so hard, you don't notice the passage of time. And I've done climbs that have lasted for 36 hours straight, and you know, you're amazed when you look at your watch and find out that you think, well, 5 or 6 hours has gone by, and really 24 or 30 has gone by. You're so tuned in. You're just in another state. It's like a clear-eyed dream. It's wonderful. That's sort of why people climb, I think.
John Krakauer is my guest, and he's a mountain climber and journalist. And his new book, Eiger Dreams, is a collection of his pieces about mountain climbing. Let me ask you about your climb up the Devil's Thumb, which is we're in Alaska.
But
just describe it for us.
The Devil's Thumb is it looks like a thumb. It's very, its proportions are quite striking. It rises very near the ocean in southeast Alaska, right on the border between the Alaskan Panhandle and British Columbia. One face of it, the north face, rises 6,000 feet from the glacier at its base. The other, the south face, rises 2,000 or 3,000. It's a big peak. It's difficult. It was first climbed in 1946 by a guy named Fred Becky. It was considered one of the hardest climb ever done in Alaska. It was one of the landmarks of American mountaineering. So it has a history. The weather there is very bad. It's close enough to the ocean that storms constantly roll through. So it's plastered with rime ice and bizarre frost feathers.
You had to wait out quite a long storm when you were preparing to climb the Devil's Summit. Is that one of the worst parts of climbing, when you're camping out waiting for a storm to end, and especially on a climb like this when you were alone?
Oh yeah, see, that's, you know, when you're at the day before, the night before, the days before, when you're tent bound are the worst, because then all the fears are sort of multiplying in your mind, and you're worried that you might get killed or get hurt, or you're worried about what might happen. So, I mean, I have an active imagination, which is not an attribute for a climber. So yeah, those are tough moments. There's nothing, you're impotent. You just lie there. There's nothing you can do. You can't even go out and walk around. The storm's howling at your tent. You can't even, there's not even room to sit up. You've read everything, every additive to the, you've read the food boxes. Everything to read has been consumed. So there's nothing to do but lie there and get scared. It's always such a relief when you finally, start climbing. It's, my God, we don't have to worry about it anymore. We're doing it. It's, whatever happens is going to happen.
Well, this was one of the first big climbs that you did. This was back in, I think, 1974. And you were working as a house builder at the time, and you'd hoped that by scaling this mountain that you would somehow change your life, that you wouldn't have to go back to the job that you didn't want anymore. And you read in your book that when you finished it, well, it didn't really change your life. You ended up having to go back to the job. And you say that this taught you a lot about what mountain climbing could and couldn't do. So tell me more about what you learned.
Again, this, when you're young, somehow you, I mean, I was obsessed with climbing. It's all I liked to do. And somehow I thought if I just did my problems stemmed, whatever they were, if I just did the perfect climb, everything would somehow turn out right. It's hard to, I mean, that seems so silly now, but I was convinced of that. If I just, this, you know, I'd do a hard climb and everything would be the same, but I just, if I just did a little better climb, somehow I'd be satisfied enough, or I don't know what. And if since I've learned that's absurd, that, life is what you put into it. It's just climbing. Climbing is not life. Climbing sort of, I still do it. I mean, but climbing doesn't generally lead to maturity, or many climbers seem to have a certain arrested development. many of my best friends are climbers.
So what are you looking for from climbing now?
Well, I don't use it to satisfy my ambitions. I do it sort of for recreation, the way that other people play tennis or golf or something. It just gets me out into the mountains, which I find incredibly fulfilling. I mean, even if I'm not climbing anything, just to be out in the mountains is, God, it really feels good. Come back from a good trip to the mountains and you're ready to deal with all the hassles that come with any job, but particularly writing, which, I've been writing for a living now for almost 7 years, and it's an intense way to make a living. It's sort of, as I've become more involved in writing, I've become less involved in climbing. It sort of replaced it. It's the same sort of intensity and craziness, but when things go wrong, you you don't die. You just have to figure out another way to pay the bills. So it's smarter thing to do, I think, as I get older.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
John Krakauer's new book on mountain climbing is titled Eiger Dreams. Krakauer's articles appear in Outside and Smithsonian magazines. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, former L.A. Laker, basketball star Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After Bobby McFerrin's surprise number one hit, he took a break from performing and public life. Now he's back leading a new a cappella group called the Voicestra. Coming up, Bobby McFerrin talks about life after Don't Worry, Be Happy. Also, rock historian Ed Ward remembers the birth of Liverpool's punk scene in the mid-70s. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Journalist and the Murderer by Janet Malcolm. It's an examination of the uneasy and perhaps unethical relationship between a reporter and his subject. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, an angry Judge Harold Green has ordered the jury sequestered in the Iran-Contra case of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter. Judge Green ordered the jury into hotel isolation at night after the news media contacted jurors at home last night. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The Washington Post's award-winning Lebanese reporter Nora Bastani, newly arrived in the U.S. from years covering the civil war in Lebanon, was one of those assigned by the Post to interview jurors after the verdict. But Bastani told colleagues she misunderstood her instructions and called a juror last night. The Post immediately informed Judge Green and apologized, but this morning the judge learned that another juror had been contacted by a reporter. In an open court session, the judge railed against the press for acting, quote, irresponsibly. He called the Post's explanation not credible and said the newspaper's actions were possibly an obstruction of justice. After questioning the jurors, however, the judge determined no actual harm had been done because the two jurors who'd been contacted hung up on the reporter or reporters. However, said the judge, in light of the incident, he could not allow the jurors to go home between their deliberations, and he ordered them to be sequestered in a Washington hotel until a verdict in the Poindexter case. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
In East Germany today, the last hurdle was cleared to open up negotiations for the first non-communist government in the country's history. Deidre Berger has more from Frankfurt.
The Liberal Social Democrats today dropped their major objection to a broad coalition government in East Germany. Until now, the Social Democrats maintained they did not want to be in a government with the German Social Union, a small right-wing party in the Conservative Alliance. But top party officials agreed for the first time today to negotiate with the winning Conservative Alliance. Negotiations for the coalition government began this afternoon in East Berlin. If successful, the new East German government will consist of all major parties except for the newly formed Communist Party. Officials from all parties involved in the negotiations say they hope the new government will be formed before Easter holidays in mid-April. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
In Washington, the Pentagon announced today that it has bought 59 of the top-secret F-117A stealth fighters over the last 9 years. Each plane cost $106 million. The aircraft, which resembles a black bat, became part of the regular U.S. arsenal in 1983, and two were used in the invasion of Panama last year. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 36 points to close at 2,736.71, on volume of some 154 million shares. There was only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. When people talking about rock and roll say Liverpool, you automatically think of the Beatles. But rock and roll historian Ed Ward says the Fab Four are only part of Liverpool's rock music story.
Without a doubt, Matthew Street in Liverpool is the city's musical mecca. Beatles stuff is everywhere, and on the side of the Cavern, the club the Fab Four made famous, there's a large shopping mall for tourists. Beatles are for sale everywhere, but across from the Cavern Walks Mall, unmarked, there's an orange door that once opened on the second chapter of Liverpool's rock and roll history.
We'll be right back.
Beatles had sapped a lot of the city's musical energy, and after them, nobody paid much attention to Liverpool, except the people who lived there. Deaf School, founded in 1974, was the only band that attracted any national attention, and they were so quirky that they only managed a cult following. Still, people were looking at Liverpool again, and on October 1, 1976, a club called Eric's opened behind that orange door on Matthews Street. Eric's quickly became the focus of the brand new punk movement, and it was there at a Clash show in 1977 that Pete Wiley, Ian McCullough, and Julian Cope first met and decided to form a band. They called themselves the Crucial Three and publicized themselves through the punk press, but never played. They couldn't have. They were three of the biggest egos in town, so they wound up forming the three biggest bands in Liverpool. Two of them debuted on the same night. McCullough's Echo and the Bunnymen were named after their drum machine, which was dubbed Echo. And while it was clear that most punk bands at the time wished they were the Stooges, the Bunnymen had been listening to the Doors. If I said I've lost my way, would you sympathize? Could you sympathize? I'm jumbled up. Maybe I'm losing my touch. I'm jumbled up. Maybe I'm losing my touch. But you know I didn't have it anyway. Won't you come on down to my? Won't you come on down to my rescue? McCullough, with his shock of hair and dressed in a thick overcoat on stage, proved to be a perfect pop star for the times. Sharing the stage with the Bunnymen that night at Eric's was Julian Cope's new band, The Teardrop Explodes. Cope, a tall blonde guy, seemed as extroverted as Ian McCullough seemed introverted, made no bones about his love of LSD when interviewed, and generally loved playing the lunatic. This may explain why The Teardrop Explodes didn't last very long. As for Pete Wiley, he seems to have been an even more volatile character. His band, Wah Heat, was hyped as the solution to everything, and Wiley didn't mind letting you know what a genius he was, something I once found out sharing a taxi across London with him. But when Wah Heat finally put out their single, 7 Minutes to Midnight, it had all the energy of punk mixed with that unique Liverpool psychedelia. When I met Wiley shortly after this record came out, the band was down to himself and a bass player, and then there were none. Strangely enough, besides the Bunnymen, the only other band from the crowd at Eric's that lasted was the one nobody thought would get very far. After all, Liverpool was about guitars, and these two guys played tinny-sounding keyboards and drum machines and sang songs with stupid industrial lyrics. And who'd ever remember a name like Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark? But ironically, keyboards and the new uses they could be put to were on the rise, and OMD, as they became known, even wound up having hits in America. The Police raided Eric's on March 14, 1980, just as Wah Heat's debut was over. It was the end for the club, but not for Liverpool, where the music's been going strong ever since.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air.
Song I wrote, you might want to sing it note for note. Don't worry, be happy.
Don't worry, be happy. The song that made Bobby McFerrin famous is also the song that caused him to retreat from the public eye for 18 months. He's back, performing with an ensemble of 10 singers called Voicestra. I asked McFerrin to tell me what kind of writing he's been doing for his new group.
In the year and a half that I've had off, I've been exploring world music, African music in particular. And so a lot of the music has a chant-like quality to it, you know, very repetitive and but earthy. And so most of the music pretty much stems from that, kind of like the old black conscious spiritualness of music, you know.
Since we don't have a record of any of the music, can I get you to hum a few bars?
Let me see. I can't sing all the parts, though. Et cetera, you know. And then there's another part that goes with it, but it's hard to do just by myself.
What are the pleasures for you of a cappella music?
Well, I'm committed to it. I like the sound of just the voice. You know, there's just something about the range, the possibilities, the color palette of the voice, the dynamics, the different timbres. It just, to me, is the supreme instrument, and I'm just in love with the sound of the voice by itself, you know.
After Don't Worry, Be Happy became a big number one hit, did you take a period off from the public?
I sure did. Oh, yes, indeed. I took about 18 months altogether. Pretty much just kept to myself. Did a lot of reading, taking a lot of time just to get quiet, and seeking solitude and a retreat from the eyes of the public. I think it's very important to do that every once in a while. And I was very happy that I was able to take the opportunity and the time to do that.
Why did you need to do that? Were there directions that you were getting pushed in? Did you feel you were losing your balance at all?
Well, there are a couple of reasons. One, that solo concerts and solo performance was not as challenging as it used to be. You know, in the beginning, I felt that I had pretty much run dry and was stuck creatively and had taken solo voice as far as I could. Another reason is that I wasn't scared anymore. Solo performance wasn't frightening. I wasn't nervous when I walked out on stage, and I was sort of on automatic pilot, and I thought that was a bit unfair to the audience to not give them my best. And I was just physically tired. I was just tired of traveling, tired of hotels, tired of missing my family and not being with them, you know. So there were spiritual and physical reasons for the break.
Oh, I lost my train of thought.
Choo-choo,
yeah. I've been listening to your records for several years, and I remember when I first heard that Don't Worry, Be Happy had reached number one, a friend told me that. I didn't believe it. Like, I thought, oh, come on, Bobby McFerrin's like number one on the pop charts?
I mean,
it just seemed so uncommon to me. How did that happen?
It happened by itself. I think that the song itself just met. I guess that's a new word. I guess you could use it. Met a need somehow, and people latched onto that piece. I was surprised on one hand because, you know, my intention never is to write a piece that I think is going to be a hit or anything like that. I think it happened accidentally that Don't Worry Be Happened happened. Don't Worry Be Happened happy. Don't Worry Be Happy happened. Anyway.
I know a lot of your songs are improvised, either on stage or in the recording studio. When you like them, you'll do them over again. How did you write Don't Worry Be Happy?
Well, that was also an improvisation, I think, that happened about 5 years ago when I was I had come up with this rhythmic lick. I simply found that melodic line. And then the space, don't worry. I just started singing, don't worry and be happy. And then would make up the lyrics on the gig, you know.
Why did you use the Jamaican accent?
You know what happened is just before I recorded that piece, I had just come from I just had lunch at a Mexican restaurant that was across the street from the studio that I was working at. And we just got into this sort of Mexican accent. It's not really Jamaican. It's sort of a cross between Jamaican and Juan, you know, from Mexico. And so when I was recording, and also in this Mexican restaurant was a poster with Mayor Bava's picture on it. It said, don't worry, be happy, which I thought was kind of cosmic. So when I went back into the studio and I started singing, I just was in that mode. I'd been joking around, you know, and speaking that way. So when I started singing the song, here's a song, let's see. I forgot the lyrics of the song. Don't worry, baby. Don't worry. Anyway, here's a song. Gosh, do you remember the lyrics?
Here's a song I wrote. I'll help you sing it note for note.
I hope you learned it.
Note for note.
So it's not really Jamaican. It was sort of the attitude that I had carried over with me from this Mexican restaurant that I had lunch.
Now, George Bush appropriated Don't Worry, Be Happy as a campaign theme. I know you didn't support George Bush. In fact, you had supported Dukakis. What did you try to do anything to get the song out of his hands?
Well, what could I have done? I mean, it's public domain. It's out there. And he just simply liked the song, you know. Some people said, well, he shouldn't be using the song as a part of his political forum. And perhaps he's right. You know, it's not a political song anyway. It's a song for everyone. He just simply liked the song and played it in some of his campaigns and... Some people were afraid that if he was playing my song, then that means that I was associated with him in some way. I mean, I'm not so attached to my material that I don't know how to answer that question. I've answered it so many times, and I still don't have an answer for it. So let's go on to something else.
During that period when you kind of took a leave of absence from Public View, you were still in Public View in the Ocean Spray commercials.
Right.
And I guess I'm wondering why you've chosen to do those commercials for so long.
Well, I just finished another one.
I think I saw it. Is it?
Yeah, about 2-3 months ago. I've done two commercials. I did one for Levi's 501 and now for the Ocean Spray. First off, I wanted to just do them. At the time when I accepted this offer to do these commercials was at a period of time in my life when I wanted to do some, you know. That's changed since. I mean, I don't plan on doing any more. I was just interested, basically. I mean, we use Ocean Spray in the house. We drink it a lot. And so I felt it was a product that I, you know, since I used it, that it would be okay to do that.
Do you worry at all about how performing in the context of commercials would affect the way people perceive your music?
No. No, I don't worry about that.
I think a lot of people used the phrase, don't worry, be happy, to kind of sum up a certain attitude of the 80s, which was, let it go, don't worry about social change. Do you know what I mean? Just think about yourself, don't worry, be happy. How did you feel when people were interpreting it as that kind of message?
To not, you're talking about complacency.
Exactly, that's the word, complacency.
Yeah. Well, that's certainly not what the song was about. You know, I was kind of unhappy that some people thought that that's what I was talking about. But I am convinced that there were, first off, there's always going to be some social issue to grapple with. And, you know, for example, the homeless and all. And I think those things are very, very important. And we need to be very vocal about things that are getting done or aren't getting done. We need to make some changes. So in a political sense, I think it's important that we really stand up for what we believe in and, you know, simply take a stand and stand firm. So the song was certainly not about that. It was not about just sort of sitting back and letting things take their course, you know, cool out. But the song is also saying to me is that we also need to dedicate ourselves personally to our own spiritual growth. I think that we don't pay too much attention to that. I mean, we spend a lot of time on things that happen outside us without paying a lot of attention or enough attention to the things that go on inside us. I think that we need to focus some attention, not in a selfish way, because we need to learn how to love again. And to love means, you know, to be able to love the most unlovable person on the face of the earth. And when you can do that, then you can really make some real changes as a society. That's, you know, that's, I think, what I was trying to say. I hope I was successful with some people, but I think a lot of people missed the mark.
Well, Bobby McFerrin, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Bobby McFerrin and his new ensemble, Voicestra, will perform in Los Angeles from April 10th to 15th. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel is with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing today about reports from the Soviet Union that there now are at least indirect, informal talks between the Kremlin and the Lithuanian leadership, which has declared independence. The talks seem to be carried out by Alexander Yakovlev, who's a member of the Politburo and one very close to Gorbachev. We'll talk, we'll hear from Moscow. We'll also talk with the Lithuanian president once again, Vytautas Landsbergis. We'll also hear about women in Japanese politics, some resentment after the way the women's issue was treated in the last parliamentary election. And we'll talk with a man who has compiled a book of famous rejection letters sent to writers by publishers.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Janet Malcolm is a writer for The New Yorker. Her controversial articles on the ethics of journalism are now the basis of a new book called The Journalist and the Murderer. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
Last year in The New Yorker, Janet Malcolm attacked Joe McGinnis for bad faith. While writing Fatal Vision, his bestseller on the Jeffrey McDonald murder case, McGinnis had pretended to be McDonald's friend and to believe in his innocence. From prison, Jeffrey sued Joe, not for slander, but for breach of contract. Looking at the smarmy letters Joe wrote to Jeffrey, Malcolm decided that the author had not only lied to and exploited the prisoner, but alas and alack, and I quote, "Every journalist knows that what he does is morally indefensible. He is a kind of confidence man, preying on people's vanity, ignorance, or loneliness, gaining their trust and betraying them without remorse." At this, many reporters bellowed in rage, some of them cried in their beer, and one of them, John Taylor, reminded readers of New York Magazine that Malcolm herself had been just as cozy with an unpleasant shrink whom she later savaged and who sued her just like Jeff and Joe. Because Malcolm had written so much about Freud and psychoanalysis, Taylor suggested that maybe her attack on McGinnis was a kind of guilty projection or displacement. More rage, more tears, and lots of journalism school symposiums on ethics. Now we get the book, which is Malcolm's original article, a couple of footnotes, and a 15-page afterword that entirely ignores the substance of Taylor's counterattack. Because Malcolm writes so well about fiction, biography, romantic myth, Philip Roth, and Joseph Conrad, it's possible to body surf these waves of rhythmic prose all the way to her complacent shore without ever really noticing that she's almost always wrong, in general and in the particulars. Unlike McGinnis, Malcolm didn't attend McDonald's trial, but she nevertheless believes him innocent, on a hunch, in the face of evidence about which she's astonishingly cavalier, uninformative, and dismissive, like the bloody syringe, the blue threads, the left chest puncture, and Kimberly's urine. She refuses to mention, much less confront, the real threat of a breach of contract suit against a writer, an end run around the libel laws and the First Amendment. It occurs to her that lawyers often cajole, just like journalists. It does not occur to her that so do parents, so do all of us in the real world. If McGinnis invented his own McDonald, so does Malcolm invent her own McGinnis, out of what seems in these pages to be an unacknowledged personal antipathy. And at one point, she even contradicts herself on who holds the upper hand. The subject, she says, like the patient, dominates the relationship and calls the shots. The journalist cannot create his subjects any more than the analyst can create his patients. So what's all the fuss about? If I'm inclined to believe Joe more than Janet, without entirely trusting either of them since they both have their career agendas, it's because from Joe I get more facts and less irony. This is often a problem with The New Yorker. Finally, crucially, not every journalist betrays his subject. Not Tony Lucas in Common Ground, not James Agee or George Orwell or Ida Tarbell or I.F. Stone or Penny LaRue or Donald Woods, and so on. An honor roll with which any journalist ought to acquaint herself before, from a glass house, she slings stones.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Journalist and the Murderer by Janet Malcolm. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, basketball great Kareem Abdul-Jabbar talks about his 20 years in the NBA. And comedy great Imogene Coca tells us about her upcoming reunion with Sid Caesar. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.